1 year ago this week, Officer Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd. In broad daylight, while dozens of witnesses watched, filmed, and pleaded with him to stop. Now, three other police officers face charges of aiding and abetting second-degree murder because they failed to intervene. The callous cruelty of these officers, undeterred by knowing they were being watched and recorded, convinced many Americans that policing reform is insufficient. This time, organizers demanded full abolition or significant defunding of police. Initially, police abolitionists enjoyed some modest victories by securing promises to shift municipal budget priorities in nearly two dozen cities. For example, Seattle cut $3 million from its policing department and used a process of community participatory budgeting to reallocate the funds. And in the city where police killed George Floyd, Minneapolis City Council President Linda Bender made this promise last summer.
Our commitment is to end our city's toxic relationship with the Minneapolis Police Department, to end policing as we know it, and to recreate systems of public safety that actually keep us safe.
Now, 1 year later, the movement to defund or abolish police has proved as complicated and halting as earlier reform movements. Opponents of defunding have blamed these leaner policing budgets for a post-quarantine uptick in crime, and police unions have remained largely intractable. Local budget processes are far more opaque than some may have anticipated. If the conventional imperative to
follow the money
is accurate, just where do we arrive when we follow the dollars spent and cut from American police budgets during this turbulent year? I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and discussing how police funding has or hasn't changed is where we start today on The Takeaway. For more on this, we're joined now by Barry Friedman, professor and founding director of the Policing Project at New York University School of Law. And along with Barry is Howard Henderson, professor of Texas Southern University and the founding director of the Center for Justice Research. Howard and Barry, welcome.
Hi.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to just start with this question. Do police make us safe?
That's a really hard question. And the information on it is, the data on it is really very, very mixed. And when you say safe, I just want to make the point, Melissa, that safe means both, you know, addressing issues of crime, but it also means being safe from the police. And too often when we think about public safety, we think about one of those two things and not the other. But if you want an accurate vision of whether we're being safer because of policing, you have to look at both of them. When you do, it's a mixed bag. There are some studies that suggest some policing tactics are successful in some ways, but the numbers are much lower than you might think. And we really, as in too much around policing, we lack a knowledge base.
Howard, do you want to jump in on this as well?
Yeah, I want to jump in on it. And I think Barry is absolutely right in the fact that there's a mixed bag. But I will also say that the critics of the police movement assert that we need more funding in policing with armed policing across the country, but there's insufficient data to support the position in either direction. In fact, the research has found that the police don't have a notoriously efficient track record of solving violent crime per se, but further, what the research does show us is that 70% of robberies and 66% of rapes, 47% of aggravated assaults, and 38% of murders go unsolved each year. So the data, again, provides us a position where we're not sure exactly how effective police are, and I think that lies the problem.
So for me, that is kind of this core underlying set of assumptions. If we believe that police make us safe, then of course we want to give more resources to whatever it is that would keep us safe, right? Whether it is, you know, a lock on our front door or whether it is a new police precinct. But if those aren't the things that keep us safe, then how might we want to reallocate budgets so that we are safer? Do we have any data that suggests, in fact, we become safer socially as well as maybe safer from the police?
We do know that funding alternatives to policing have been effective. We know that forcing police to focus on a more community health approach, using mental health services as an alternative, saves us time, saves us money, and saves us lives. We understand that alternatives are effective. The problem is we are forced with trying to change the mindset of Americans who have been focused on policing and social control as a normal mechanism.
I just want to go to precisely that point. There's a political question here, right? There's a question of what that word defunding means, what it prompts, and whether or not it's actually attached to these practices of making us safer.
Right. So one thing we might need to do is think about what safety even means. And I think that is exactly what many of the communities that are raising issues about defunding are asking. So safety means freedom from third-party violence. I think we can all agree about that. But it also means, you know, adequate food and housing and jobs and opportunities. So one of the things we know, for example, is that money that is put into youth job programs actually brings down crime and makes society more productive. And so what we need to do is think about whether there are resources in society that we can devote to underlying problems and actually solve them. You know, one of the things that happens is people call 911. They don't call the police, by the way. They call 911 and we send the police. And the police come, but it's rare that the police can actually solve that problem. And so very often police might stabilize things, perhaps with some harm. But the question is, have we tackled the underlying problem that brought them there in the first place?
Howard, help me to understand why police budgets are as large as they are right now in the first place.
Let's use this. In the U.S., we spend an estimated $100 billion on policing every year. Most of that is based upon the perception of fear. We have been taught and trained that the police are necessary in society at the level that they currently are. While we need to begin to invest in, as Barry said, in education, healthcare, housing, and other critical programming, we've just been trained and acculturated to believe that policing needs to be as bloated as it is.
Now, Barry, right now, in part because of that training that we have, this belief, as we're seeing an uptick in some forms of property crime, some forms of violent crime in some cities, kind of as the quarantine rules are lifting and more people are heading back out into interaction with each other, you're seeing, I'm certainly seeing the op-eds popping up across the country saying this is a result of defunding the police. Is that accurate?
So I don't think there's any basis for saying that the uptick in crime is a result of defunding the police, because even if that were the proper relationship between defunding and crime, it's just too soon. Police forces have gotten smaller because of attrition. It's been a difficult time. But there are lots of causes of current uptick in crime, and we just don't really understand them. The question is whether we could be safer by using policing. And here again, though perhaps that is the case, and many people feel that it's the case, you also have to ask about the costs of trying to address that crime in the way we do. So, for example, in most police departments, the way they tackle violent crime is through stops, pretextual stops, traffic stops, pedestrian stops. And those have really serious costs. And it's unclear that they actually have the impact of bringing down crime. So the question is whether we could allocate those resources to police presence without the enforcement, or whether we could bring in violence interrupters, which are private individuals who help bring peace to the city streets. And those are all hard questions. But, you know, in this country, we have a sort of snap judgment mindset about policing. You're for them or against them without thinking really thoughtfully about what would make us safer.
So I want to dig into the financial piece for one second, because one of the critical findings out of the Ferguson report, which came out of the death of Michael Brown, was that the police, it wasn't even so much about how much money was going into policing, but how much municipal revenue was being generated by police. So those stops that you just talked about, Barry, were creating resources, dollars, right, for municipalities. How do we manage that part if cities are actually reliant on these sort of, you know, small, you know, nonviolent crime, preemptive stops of police in order to basically keep their revenue up?
Yeah, well, you know, anywhere that happens, it's an abomination. Cities should not be raising their money through policing. I'm part of a project with the American Law Institute, which has just recently said that. And, you know, that's the irony of this, which is when you're thinking about public safety, you have to think about the impacted communities, the Black and Brown communities that feel that both experience the crime and feel the pressure of policing. And one of the things we hear out of those communities is that they are being hit with fines and fees all the time, which then, you know, they maybe folks can't afford. And so then they end up with warrants out on them and then they get arrested. And there's this spiral that that actually ends up costing us a tremendous amount of money as a society and does not really solve problems. And so, again, it would be better if we policed smarter, whether that's using the police or whether that's using private resources than the way that we currently do.
Howard, I want to ask you about Black and brown communities, because a lot of times there is, at least in our sort of public discourse about it, there's this idea that maybe there's a generational divide, or that there's a class divide, that there are some Black folks who really want more policing and others who want to defund or abolish. How would you sort of reflect on what those divides look like and how they complicate this story?
You know, the reality is there is a Black-white divide. The most recent polls show us that Blacks still have the most negative view of the police, even though that number is not as low as it used to be. There's still a divide there. You also see a class dimension. And reality is there is a different experience in this country with American policing based upon race and class. And we have not done a very good job of addressing that issue and that divide.
So here's one big thing I keep hearing from former police officers, and that is that the culture of the policing itself is a challenge, that what happens in that sort of behind that blue line. Wouldn't defunding potentially actually make that problem worse, or at least not address it, right? If there's a toxic police culture, it can be better or less well-resourced. But should we care about and try to address police culture?
I think that's the broader issue, and I thank you for raising that question. We have several examples of police departments that have defunded or reallocated resources and addressed the direct culture. And they've been fairly successful so far, even though we need a little more time to understand the longstanding effect of defunding or reallocation of services. But I think a lot of what we're talking about here is a matter of perception. It's a matter of tradition, and many officers are not used to that form of policing that society is now requesting and expecting.
Barry, I want to give you the last one on this. And what I heard from Howard is sometimes we need a little more time. What should be the measures that we're using to determine whether or not any of the reforms that we seek to implement are in fact being successful, making us safer?
Yeah, I hate to say it, but that's the million-dollar question, which is for a long time, policing drove on measures like how many folks got arrested, what were the number of stops that the police conducted. And we've, I think, all become dissatisfied with that. But we don't have good measures to replace that. Folks want to look at the crime rate, but you know, you will find that some folks are eager to take credit when the crime rate goes down, but not eager to accept the responsibility when the crime rate goes up. And I think policing, you know, over the run of history doesn't affect that crime rate that much. So we have to look at what are the things we want out of policing, like Howard says. Do we want to know whether the community feels safe? Do we want to know whether the community feels comfortable calling 911? That's a really important measure. Does the community have satisfaction with its policing agency? And those are at least some of the questions we can ask. But the truth is, this is a real unknown and something we need to work on.
Howard Henderson is the founding director of the Center for Justice Research, and Barry Friedman is the founding director of the Policing Project at NYU School of Law. Thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
Yep, thank you.
Now we're going to focus in on one city's efforts to reallocate funds back to community. This week, the Los Angeles City Council approved its plans to divert funds away from the police department budget from last year and into programs ranging from homelessness services to anti-gang initiatives. In total, $89 million will be going into these social programs. At the same time, Mayor Eric Garcetti and the City Council recently increased the LAPD's budget for the new fiscal year, frustrating many activists hoping for real, lasting, systemic change. Here to walk us through all of this is Dakota Smith, staff writer at the Los Angeles Times. Dakota, thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So let's just start with the latest. How did the City Council in Los Angeles settle on the sort of size of the funds that would be reallocated away from the police?
Well, this all first happened as protests were still going on last year. There was a lot of anger on the streets. The National Guard had come in. It was a very tense time. And the City Council and the mayor, they clearly wanted to respond to what was going on. So the City Council came forward and said, we're going to cut $150 million from the police budget and put it towards disenfranchised communities, communities of color. How they came up with that number, not entirely clear, but it was a big number and it got national press and people responded. Activists said, it's not enough. Other groups said, this is the first step. After that promise last year, they finalized the list this week, and that money will start coming into communities.
But then what's the deal here about more resources next year allocated to the police?
Yeah, so the budget that will start July 1st in Los Angeles, in fact, will slightly increase spending for the police department. And the argument there is that with retirements of officers and with resignations of officers, the police force is going down. And at the same time, we're seeing some rise in certain types of crimes, shootings, homicides. And there is concern about keeping the LAPD at certain levels. So the city council wants to continue to fund the police department in order to have those officers on the streets. But at the same time, there are fewer officers. There's going to be fewer officers compared to a year ago, just because of attrition. So they're really trying to just sort of keep things level, I guess they would probably argue.
Okay, so if we know that that there's this kind of balancing out around officers and the size of the department, what is going to grow? Where are resources going to be reallocated into spaces that aren't about policing?
You know, that so it was $150 million, and then about $60 million of it actually went to go help balance the city's budget. So that left about $90 million or so. And that's going to a variety of programs, some of which you mentioned, gang intervention workers, youth education and jobs programs, park improvements. And that some of the money has been criticized by the police union because it's going to do things like fix streets. At the same time, activists are supportive and they're happy that the money's going to help things like reentry programs after people get out of prison to help them find jobs. So this is not an insignificant amount of money that's going to flow to these programs.
Can you back up for me a second, though? When you talk about both balancing the budget with some portion of it and also doing some sort of broader municipal actions like street repair, like that's the classic things that cities must do, keep the streets good. It sounds to me, and please let me know if this is wrong, it sounds to me like the pressure that came from the Movement for Black Lives to reallocate funds basically allowed the city to take a kind of a loan off the police department budget, but didn't really respond to what that movement was asking for relative to a new way of thinking about public safety.
I think there's a bit more to pick apart there. If we go back a year ago, LA was in a budget crisis. This was before, you know, $1 billion flowed in from the Biden administration. LA was really struggling, and it was struggling with and looking at having to potentially lay off city workers who make up. There's a lot of black and brown people who work for the city. And so the city was struggling. Are we going to lay off a lot of city workers or furlough them? So that when I say the balance of city budget, they wanted to protect those workers. So that's why some of the money went the city budget, if that makes sense. Your broader criticism, what really changed, I think that's totally valid. What I think activists would say and what is concerning right now is that this was a one-time allocation of money, this $90 million or so. Are these programs going to be funded next year?
Right. And sort of your point about protecting the jobs of city workers then become protecting the jobs of those, you know, folks who are now running those programs. Let me ask one last question in our last few seconds here. What was the budget process itself? Did community get a voice in where that $150 million went?
They certainly did. You had a wide array of groups, community groups, asking for specific programs to be funded. You had some neighborhoods too, who said, we want these types of services. At the same time, you know, there's tensions over you want more cops or you want less cops. Different neighborhoods have different views. So there was community input, and City Hall did respond.
Dakota Smith is a staff writer at the Los Angeles Times. And Dakota, thank you for bringing the complexity of this. It's not simple.
It's not simple. Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, a little story. Last summer, my family and I, we knew we were really lucky because in the midst of a deadly global pandemic, we had a home, jobs we could do remotely, and secure health insurance. Also, rather incredibly, we had a brilliant millennial with an elementary education degree who had just rented our guest house. So under these circumstances, I definitely didn't feel like I could do a lot of quarantine complaining. Still, like so many others, our crew felt isolated. We felt the loss of long-anticipated moments, like that moment when my eldest daughter graduated high school in our living room. And all of us spiraled with grief and rage when Breonna Taylor was killed in her own bed, and Ahmaud Arbery was hunted and shot, and when George Floyd was murdered in broad daylight. So, facing a summer, last summer, without camps or travel or even playdates, I knew I had to do something to counter this world of illness, death, and loss that was threatening to consume us. And that is when I launched our family's Black Joy Camp. Together, our family,
James,
Parker,
Anna,
Melissa, created a 10-week plan to get us through the summer. We focused on topics like sports, stories, art, music, science, robotics, and yes, social change.
All right, so again, it's our first day of camp, and we're doing sports today, remember?
Yeah.
And what is the theme of our camp?
Black joy.
Black joy. And again, what does joy mean to you?
Love, peace, and happiness.
Love, peace, and happiness. So, our sports camp, where we're going to have love, peace, and happiness, one of the things we have to have is healthy bodies. Healthy bodies that do fun things. So today, we're going to stretch, we're going to run, we're going to drink some water.
We read books about Mae Jemison, Shirley Chisholm, and Simone Biles. We memorized Nikki Giovanni poetry and learned how to spot a Basquiat painting. Brianna led our Black girl yoga every morning, and my daughters had parent-free sister time every afternoon. During Music Week, we listened to Ella Fitzgerald.
Yeah. Ooh, I know a music song.
Tell me a music song.
A duet.
Well, you don't sound like Ella Fitzgerald, that's for sure.
I was doing a duet.
Okay. Do you remember when Ella Fitzgerald said, accentuate the positive and eliminate the negative?
Yes.
And what did that mean?
Good things bigger, bad things smaller.
You got it!
And during Feel Good Week, we got intentional about loving the beautiful Black selves we see in the mirror.
And what about your face? What do you see when you look at Anna's face?
He looks beautiful.
It does? I think so, too. Do you love yourself? How much?
100%.
Grandpa Perry led a Zoom session about James Weldon Johnson, and Cousin Chris taught us basketball moves virtually. We made vision boards, and we wrote our very own storybook. It was called Cupcake's Birthday.
They jump on the trampoline and on the slide. Cupcake goes first because she is a birthday girl.
We walked barefoot in the grass, chalked the driveway, and every single day, we consciously cultivated joy. How do you practice Black joy? Give us a call. The number is 877-869-8253, or you can send a voice memo to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. And now I'm happy to welcome Badia Ahad Lagardi. She's professor and vice provost for faculty affairs at Loyola University Chicago. She's also the author of Afro Nostalgia, Feeling Good in Contemporary Black Culture. Badia, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I was raised in a Black Southern tradition that distinguished between joy and happiness. Do you make this distinction?
You know, I see them rather synonymously, I have to say, but joy is something that I think is really broad. And especially when we think about Black joy, I like to link it to the psychological. So that might be the distinction that I make. Happiness is more of an emotional feeling, and joy, I think, is really tied to the psychological.
So I spent a lot of time last night in this book, in Afro Nostalgia, and I loved how you articulated these kind of critical ideas about nostalgia and joy, and particularly how they connect with contemporary Black experiences and historical ones. So make that connection for our listeners. What is that connection between nostalgia and joy?
You know, nostalgia has enjoyed a rather recent renaissance, especially in psychology. And what a lot of recent studies have found is that nostalgia is really crucial to cultivating joy. So it's an emotion that encourages feelings of belonging. It contributes to feelings of self-worth. It gives us a sense of hope and optimism for the future, which is really interesting because usually people think about nostalgia in terms of the past, but really nostalgia does a lot in the way of giving us a sense of possibility for what lies ahead. And it also promotes feelings of joy and self-esteem.
I kept thinking the two things that created such collective joy in the context of the quarantine for COVID-19 was club quarantine, right? Where suddenly we realized, oh, not only do we need to be together, but we needed to be together in this kind of musically nostalgic way. And then also verses, right? Which brings back all the, you know, the old groups to battle each other sonically. And I just thought, yeah, there it is. There's Black nostalgia and Black joy together.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, what's really important about that is to pay attention to the creative process, right? So really Black people doing what we've always done in really difficult circumstances, which is to create, to be in community, to cultivate joy. And so I think that those examples that you just named are perfect.
So one of the other things that it seems you're seeking to do with this text is to unlink the idea that Black memory is always about trauma. So how, though, do we connect our memories, particularly our collective memories of trauma, so many of which were reproduced in this difficult year, and yet also the idea of nostalgia and of memory being a space of joy and happiness?
Sure. So, you know, I would certainly never suggest that, you know, we ignore, right, the harsh realities of the moment and certainly the circumstances of the past, especially that kind of narrative of trauma that I think we know so well. But I think it's also really important to be mindful that there are other aspects of Black life that allow us to cope with those difficult moments and really withstand those difficult circumstances. So for me, Black joy really functions as a form of resistance, and it's really central to our own survivability.
All right. So let's talk about some specific aspects of Black joy, like practices, things we can do. What is the Knapp Ministry?
Oh, well, the Knapp Ministry. So Tricia Hersey is the founder and self-proclaimed bishop of the Knapp Ministry, and she's a visual artist. But I would say that she's so much more than that. She's someone who basically suggests that because African Americans or our enslaved ancestors were robbed of their ability to sleep at will and thus deprived of their ability to dream, that as a form of reparations, contemporary Black folks should actually really embrace rest and leisure and pleasure and all the things that our enslaved ancestors were denied. So that is her ministry, and she does a wonderful job of creating spaces of rest and restoration for everyone, but particularly for African Americans.
It's funny, when I first encountered that thought, I was like, oh, of any form of resistance, I can surely do this. But then it turns out it's quite a bit harder than I expected, that being intentional about resting is maybe the thing I'm least good at.
Yeah, I think it is. Especially just with so much going on and so much that has gone on, especially within the past year, it's been very difficult to attempt to even escape the just bustle of the day and all of the, you know, series of news events, especially the negative news events that come across our social media feeds and our radios and our televisions on a daily basis. But it's also so central, I think, to be very intentional about self-care in these moments. And I, you know, love seeing the renaissance of Audre Lorde and, you know, promoting self-care as a form of resistance, right? And it's not something that we should take for granted, but it's something that we should take ownership of. And I think that's really at the core of Hersey's work as well. But, you know, I've actually really loved watching other people engage in acts of joy. So that's been, you know, a source of joy for me as well.
Tell me about that.
You know, I was just thinking about how I'm on social media a lot, I have to say, probably more than I should be. I'm on Instagram, and I love seeing, you know, Eve Ewing, who's a scholar that I just really admire. She's on Instagram baking bread. You know, I've recently started following Alexis Nicole, and she's a Black forager, and she does things like candy pine cones and make scones out of dandelions and things like that. It's just so fascinating to watch people really be creative and really be out in the world and just doing the things that they enjoy and that they love. And that really brings me joy as well. And just full disclosure, I'm a golfer, and the weather's finally turned nice in Chicago. So I've been doing a lot of that. And it's always nice watching Troy Mullins, who's one of my favorite golfers, one of the few Black women golfers, really do her thing on the circuit. So that's been fun to watch too.
So, Badia, in that moment, you were so incredibly generous thinking about your own joy connected to these experiences of just watching others in their moment of joy. But one of the things I must say I loved about the book was that you also talk about the affective power of the petty. And I must say, I do get a little bit of joy from hanging out in Petty Corner. What do you mean by the affective power of the petty, especially as we're looking back, right, historically?
Sure. So that chapter is really about the ways in which, it's really about historical novels of slavery, right? And how contemporary writers have attempted to enact justice through literature for the their enslaved ancestors, I would say. And, you know, what's really powerful to me in those texts is that, you know, not every act of resistance was about, you know, fighting back physically or running away from the plantation, so to speak, but really about paying attention to the emotional slights or the ways in which people were deceptive. And I think Angela Davis actually talks about this a little bit in one of her essays, in that sometimes enslaved people practiced resistance by just slowing down their work pace or, you know, doing certain things to just resist their contemporary circumstances. And so that's what I kind of link to the petty in that particular chapter.
With so much pain and trauma, with so much partisan division, what do you say to people who think that joy is simply too frivolous for the time?
Well, you know, I think back to something that my mother would always say to me, which is, don't let other people steal your joy. And what she meant by that, I think, was that that is something that is really mine to hold on to. It's mine to claim. And it's important to keep it and to hold it dear. That the way I see it, just for myself and operative in Black culture, is that it really is an expression of freedom. It's an expression of one's sense of agency, of being fully in possession of your psychological and emotional life. And that's something that we shouldn't take for granted, right? I mean, it's not to deny the traumatic circumstances of the past and of the present, but it's also really important to claim ownership of your whole self. And that includes being, you know, a person who experiences positive emotions, of which joy is an important one.
Badia Ahad Lagardi is an associate professor and vice provost for faculty affairs at Loyola University Chicago. Now, we always want to hear from you. Give us a call and leave us a message telling us, what does Black joy mean to you and where do you find it? Our number is 877-869-8253. Again, that's 877-869-8253. Now, what is the social scene that you are most missing over the past year? For me, it is house parties. Kick back in familiar spaces with familiar faces, music, laughter, and very loud, we'll call them discussions. I can't wait for it to be safe for us to all gather again like that. But while we're waiting, we can engage the intimacy, hilarity, and spirit of the house party in a brand new late night show hosted by comedian Sam Jay. A show that doesn't really look or sound like anything else on television right now.
I thought Uncle Ben was a rice tycoon. I didn't think that was a butler. I was like, this is in a suit. This runs rice. I was proud to buy that rice. I didn't know nothing. I didn't even know the narrative. Y'all just threw a hoe. This was a butler slave. This was a rice god to me. That's what I thought.
Okay, so Pause with Sam Jay had its premiere last Friday on HBO. And Jay told me she isn't trying to reach an advertiser-friendly demographic through her show.
Just trying to talk to people that I guess can feel what I'm talking about. I don't know if it's like, you know, ages 35 to, I don't think that's specific for me. You know what I mean? I just felt like these are things that me and my friends talk about. This is stuff, these are conversations that I'm around a lot and are being had. And I wanted to bring some like rawness and honesty to the screen.
And it is raw. Look, in her stand-up, Jay makes bold jokes that often touch on big ideas.
Go to the British Museum, it's huge. I was overwhelmed. I walked in, I was like, holy, because it was wing after wing after wing of stuff. And it blew my mind because I was like, wow, white people stole all this. Stole so much. It's stolen. That's crazy.
On her late night show, she brings a similar energy, tackling topics that the audience, and maybe especially like us ex-gen Black viewers, might be clutching our pearls and a little surprised to see discussed so openly on television. The premiere episode delves into what it means when Black people are viewed as being too close or too comfortable around whiteness.
It was just the topic we had a lot to say about when it came up in the room. It sparked a lot of conversation amongst us. And I think when we find things that spark a lot of conversation amongst us in the room, then we tend to push towards them because we're like, oh, we're talking about it, or we're feeling divided about it, then it's probably worth exploring.
And interestingly, Jay said that white folks weren't exactly on her mind when she was creating the show.
Not really. I mean, not in the sense of like, oh, how am I going to get them to understand this? I just felt like, you know, you can follow this if you want to like open your mind up a little bit and follow this. And I didn't want to be explaining myself and explaining Blackness. You know what I mean? It was just like, if you're down to listen and you're down to clown, like, come get down. But if I'm being honest, I wasn't really speaking to them.
So if you are down to listen and you are down to clown, Jay is going to do some fascinating things for you. She's more likely, for example, to seek out Black people whose perspectives aren't always highlighted on TV. Like the conservatives she interviews in the first episode.
When you say pro-Black conservative, mm-hmm. what does that look like? I don't think I've ever heard those words put together, let alone have a picture in my head of how that's active.
I'll list it out. I'm a constitutionalist. I'm a capitalist. I mean, when I say capitalist, I don't mean like, oh, like just abolish welfare. I mean like abolish the Federal Reserve. Like I'm a capitalist. So to me, that's conservative. And then when I add my pro-Black lens in front of it, okay, I'm like, how do I specifically apply these policies to the Black community?
I don't interview people. It's not like a profession of mine. So I was like, you know, I am a naturally curious person and I do enjoy talking to people. And so I tried to just approach it more like a conversation than an interview. Like, I didn't really have an agenda. I didn't want to get something out of them. I didn't want like a gotcha moment as much as I was just really curious about them, who they were and why they made the choices that they made. And so I think that made it a little easier on me to navigate the conversation.
And that curiosity, it creates a kind of depth to the show. And Jay's depth is also related to her willingness to be introspective. For example, she speaks frankly about the pushback she received from her own LGBTQ+ community after a joke she made about transgender women.
Just look at my special. I do a trans joke in a way that I thought was on some that was gonna advance a conversation truly in my heart. But to gay, like they look at me as a gay. At the end of the day, I read that's being said, and it's basically like I align myself with straight people. I don't hang out with a lot of gay people.
I can't ask for honesty from others and honesty from the guests and the people in the room if I'm not giving that. And so, I mean, really, that's what it stems from for me, is just being true to myself and true to the things that I want to discuss and I think are important.
In many ways, these conversations that Jay is having on her late night show are an extension of her stand-up. But her comedic voice has also been sharpened by years as a writer for SNL.
Well, I mean, when you're writing for like a show, like you're writing for SNL, then you're writing for the people too, you know, so you're trying to get your voice into Kate McKinnon's mouth and body in some ways. And so in that regard, you have to think more about the whole, where in stand-up, you just got to think about yourself. But when you're writing and casting, you have to think, what is Kate good at? What is AD good at? What is a good role for Keenan? What does Keenan do well? How are they going to score in this? And how are they going to be successful in this as much as how am I going to get the jokes I want to get out and across?
I have no doubt that in the coming years, you're going to hear and see a lot more of Sam Jay as she continues to rise in the comedy world. But for now, she's feeling good about what she was able to achieve through her late night show.
I already feel like it's a success because it's done and I like made it and I did it. And I'm like, wow, I got to do something that was uniquely me, authentically me, and I got to share it with the world, really. So, yeah, it's happened already. I think anything else that comes of it is like a bonus.
One place you won't be seeing her anytime soon is in a comedy version of Versus, something Jay says she just cannot wrap her head around.
No, I can't. But people want to see something like that. I've noticed people want to see comics like battle, but I don't really know what that looks like. Comedy is so like individual and like hyper nuanced. You know what I mean? So it's like, what is a comedy battle? Like, how do you judge that?
I'm not sure how you judge it, but I still got to say, I want to see it. Pause with Sam Jay airs Fridays at 9 p.m. on HBO. You can also watch it on HBO Max. Okay, y'all, that's all we have for you today. Really appreciate you being here with us. And remember, if you have any show suggestions or ideas, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can also record a voice memo on your phone and email it to thetakeawaycallers@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.